We're talking about organic food fraud here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. While food fraud isn't new, the motivation to skirt regulations for financial gain is very real. Just this week, the Justice Department announced two executives of a now-defunct meatpacking operation. They pleaded guilty to selling more than $1 million worth of tainted beef to the federal prison system. And by the way, food fraud is a catch-all term. It's used to describe the deliberate and intentional substitution, addition, tampering, misrepresentation of food, lots of things. Are you an organic farmer? How do you feel about organic food fraud? Does that negatively affect your business? We're at 800-642-1234. John Spink is director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Supply Chain Management at MSU Business College. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, food fraud is a broad term. Let's zoom in on an instance of it. Over the summer, the largest organic food fraud case in our history was prosecuted when this farmer in Iowa had a multi-million dollar operation selling organic feed to livestock farmers who then turned around, sold their meat and eggs, and it just escalated from there. Is most food fraud this large scale?
Well, it's really interesting. One thing, it's hard to study the bad guys when they try to hide. So they're not very good research subjects in that sense. But what we do is we look at the incidents and then try to piece together how it occurred, why there was a vulnerability. But the thing we look at is there's a wide range of bad guys. And, well, we can talk about bad guys as well, but from low tech to high tech and low volume to high volume. So there can be some situations like this where the business itself is massive, and then the fraud opportunity also is massive.
So when you say the fraud opportunity is massive in that it's able to penetrate different parts of our food chain?
Yeah, well, and to step back, food fraud has been going on since beginning of almost recorded history. From 1000 BCE in China, there are stories of different types of fraud all through Europe and today. And so over time, I guess we didn't look at it in great detail because the public health threat comes and goes. When there's a health threat, like a food safety incident, we definitely move everything, all of our efforts to stop it. But all of a sudden, it was really hard to detect because the bad guys are really good at finding their way around and through the system. So over time, when it kept getting bigger and bigger of an impact for companies, for governments, we started to shift to look at the vulnerabilities. And this shifts it from just detecting fraud to looking at crime prevention, which is really preventing it.
And how do you go about preventing it? What are some of those weaknesses that we have in our global food industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that was really at the very beginning. It was about 10 years ago that we started to look at this. And really in 2012 is when the food industry started to look at the large scale, really in the large scale, looking at this through the Global Food Safety Initiative, GFSI. They're a group of industry partners that create a food safety management system. And they started to look at this and say, okay, this is a problem. We're you know, the systems are getting better at detecting it. With things like social media, information is traveling a lot farther. With better traceability systems, even different governments are sharing information about issues. And then they really said, we can't just catch it. The goal is not to catch food fraud. The goal is to stop it from occurring in the first place. So we started to look at individual incidents to see, well, what was not in place that led this to occur. For example, if you leave your front door unlocked of your house, you're less vulnerable than if you have locked your front door. That's not saying the probability that if you leave your door unlocked, you're going to get robbed today. But still, you can do little things like lock your front door. So we shifted focus in the overview to the system weaknesses. And one of them was in the UK and across Europe, their horse meat got blended in with beef illegally because horse meat is lower priced product. And one thing we saw as system weakness was that a lot of companies were not testing for species. They were testing for quality, testing for safe food safety and all these other aspects, but just not species. So in that sense, if we all of a sudden added a species test, we could catch it.
We're talking about food fraud, the deliberate tampering with food and misrepresenting products. John Spink is director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer who could qualify as organic, but you've chosen not to go through the USDA certification process? Is it not worth the money? Is it the process that is time consuming? What is it? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John, you know, I saw one estimate food fraud costs upwards of the global food industry $40 billion annually. How common is it in the U.S., and what are the dollar signs here?
Yeah, something that's been very difficult when researching any type of crime is to look for and try to estimate what the cost is. You know, the cost to society, the cost to the economy, to individuals. And this type of crime is very hidden. A lot of times we don't even know that we're consuming product that could be fraudulent. Now, a real key is that the vast majority of all food fraud incidents do not have a public health threat. And that's good and bad. It's for consumers, if we consume product that's fraudulent, then we're probably not going to get sick. But at the same time, it's harder for detection. So I think that's where this focus has been on the public health threat, and the economic piece is really, really difficult to estimate. But when we look at incidents and we build up from there, from the case studies, understanding system weaknesses across the board, then the number really starts to rise. And even if you consider things like weight might be off, or someone's cheating about the number of pounds they're selling you, all of a sudden, even those little bits of fraud could happen often and could add up quite a bit.
We get a lot of products from other countries and certainly Central South America of imports there. Do we know if food fraud is an issue when it comes to our imports, what's coming through our borders and our ports?
Well, that is a great question, and that's one of the most difficult questions, because at first we look at the basic aspects of the production of the fraudulent product. So you would say that in countries where there's a less oversight, you know, less rigorous court system, less rigorous food safety and food inspections, then the opportunity to produce fraudulent product increases. Yes. But the bad guys are smart. So a couple things that happen with some of that product from around the world that comes in is sometimes it goes through a free trade zone or a port, and they change the labels. They change the country of origin. So there was a huge case that the U.S. Customs broke and prosecuted that they called honey laundering. And so Chinese honey has a high tariff because of different aspects of that, say a 200% tariff, where a country like Thailand or the Philippines or another country like that might have a 15% tariff. So what the bad guys did is they bought that product in China, sent it to the Philippines, and then changed the label and said it was from the Philippines and imported it. So the country of origin is important to understand from the production of product. But if you're receiving product at your dock, at your restaurant, or at your manufacturer right now, it's really more important to look at the big picture of the whole supply chain.
Yeah, and certainly going up that supply chain and finding out exactly where the weaknesses are, you know, earlier and asking those questions.
That's it. Well, and along the way, there's been the classic 1980s phrase of trust but verify. And what we say is you can only trust as far back as you can trust. So if you're buying product, then the key is, you know, how much do you trust that your supplier, and then what do they have in place that increases your ability to trust them? And one thing that could be there is certifications and standards. So if they meet things like the GFSI Food Safety Management System standards, then they must have a food fraud vulnerability assessment in place, and they must have a food fraud prevention strategy in place. So if you're buying from whatever company it is, you can ask them if they're certified to a standard, and then you can ask to see their documentation and see their reports. And all of a sudden, if they have more visibility of their supply chain, then you're more confident that there's not system weaknesses.
We're looking at transparencies around food. Food fraud, John Spink is here. He heads up the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. Your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're having a discussion around food fraud, and increasing demand for organic grain is making it necessary for the USDA to be more cautious before labeling products. The USDA's National Organic Program uses a strict certification process to try to eliminate fraud and ensure integrity in organic products. But still, issues come up. Like in 2017, a large shipment of organic soybeans and corn came into the U.S. having been treated with banned pesticides. Do you have confidence in how the USDA certifies organic? Do you value organic food? Does the USDA organic label matter to you in the grocery store? Join in 800-642-1234. Michigan State University's Food Fraud Initiative Director John Spink is our guide. John, we've looked more broadly here at food fraud. Help us understand what it can look like with organic products in the organic industry.
Yeah, with food fraud, we look at different attributes of products. And one of them that's really challenging are when there's attributes that you can't really see. So if you look at two products and one is organic and one's not, that's something that's hard for us to really identify as consumers. So definitely something like organic product has a fraud opportunity. So what we do is we look at that and then try to figure out how and why it occurs and then try to reduce the vulnerabilities. And one thing that started is the USDA has their organic focus and their organic program. With every type of system that gets in place, a key is just starting, but then start to look at it. You know, in business and things, we talk about plan, do, check, act, and repeat. And so that's one thing that's happened is that the USDA with their organic program is just continuing to improve along the way.
So what about consumer confidence here as they are a little bit skeptical about whether their organic products are really passing USDA standards?
Yeah, I mean, all along the way, consumer confidence is key to everything because, you know, the whole system, if consumers aren't confident in the product that they're buying, then they're going to stop buying, especially if it's a value-added ingredient or a value-added process like organic. And the key is that awareness, and there's definitely a huge opportunity for the U.S. economy to really grow in this area with the high-quality processing and farming practices. And the key is this with USDA of starting the process and then looking for those system weaknesses and changing and adapting. One thing that USDA has done recently is with Organic Trade Association is to start to create a training modules for people. It's very basic. We work with them on the food fraud aspect for overviews and think like a criminal type stuff. But what the key is that we start to share the information, and now we're starting to gather incident reviews across the entire industry, and we're getting better at understanding the weaknesses and what we need to do to close those down.
So does food fraud have an environmental impact? What are you seeing there?
Oh, yeah, environmental. It's been especially, in the U.S., but around the world, especially in some developing countries, it's been just astronomical, the impact. Because when we look at food fraud, we look at all types of activities related to food, and a big one is the use of chemicals in production, such as pesticides, you know, fertilizer, things like that. And there's constant stories where the local farmer is not confident that their pesticide is watered down, that they then double dose, and sometimes they've got pesticide that's twice as strong as they think it is, and that causes a lot of problems in the fields and in those production areas. The second is that there's not a monitoring of these fraudulent operations. So if a retailer is buying from a supplier that has good manufacturing practices or fair trade in another country, then they're monitoring and they're trying to really help to grow and sustain those farmers. With a fraudulent product, then, you know, if it passes through a free trade zone or whatever and the label changes, you don't know the source, then it would be illogical that the bad guys are not cutting corners, because we have to start with the idea that these are sociopaths. They're not afraid of cheating us or harming us in some way economically, and they're criminals, so they're not afraid of breaking the law. And that's where we have to start when we think about fraudsters.
We're exploring all facets of food fraud with John Spink. He directs the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an organic farmer? How do you feel about organic food fraud? Does that negatively affect your business? Did you used to be a conventional farmer and then you switched to organic? What differences have you noticed? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's, John, understand a little bit more what motivates farmers to do this. Is this all about economics, all about the money?
Yeah, well, there's two sides about looking at the bad guy and what they're doing. Now what we see from the research is there's a wide range of actors in the system. Some are just very simple, might be a one-off, like maybe you sell a truckload of something and they accidentally had the weight scales off and you sold double. And you made money, you know, you on that. And then on the other end are really full-blown, complete professional criminals. They're part of professional organizations. They know they're committing criminal acts. But most of the fraudsters fall in the middle range there, where they kind of know something's not right. They're cutting a corner, like, well, they didn't know, so it's not that bad. It's not making anybody sick. I think what happens a lot of times is that there's a slippery slope. And at the very beginning, maybe money is a little tight right now, and all of a sudden you realize when you sold that product that someone paid 50% more for the weight and you didn't correct them. And all of a sudden then you let that one go by, and well, it was pretty nice having that extra $1,000. And the next time it happens, well, you did it again. Well, all of a sudden, by the time you've done it a couple times, just almost like without having an action, just you didn't correct them, that all of a sudden you realize that you're committed a criminal act. And at that point, then a lot of people just kind of cross their fingers and hope for the best. And it's hard to come back from that point. So it's very tempting.
Let's bring in a call now. Marty joining us from Palmyra. Hi, Marty.
Good morning. My question is, Whole Foods, they seem to have a system that monitors the vendors they buy from and, truthfully, what they are offering is what it is, you know, organic. Are you aware of that? And if so, is that not a model that should be applied across the board to, say, the organic industry? And I'll listen to your response off air.
Thanks, Marty. John, what about the Whole Foods model? What do we know there?
Well, what I can say is that broadly across the industry is that, well, number one, if a food fraud incident occurs at a retailer. So let's say the retailer is the victim as well. The key is you go to that retailer and they hand you the product and say, here, this is good, take it, you know, enjoy. So you hold them accountable. And if anything happens there, you know, you may stop going to that store. The impact on their business is tremendous. And all of a sudden a whole new, say there's some new spice that's the magic spice that's going to solve everybody's problems, and they have that product. Maybe it costs a lot. Something like CBD right now, some of the CBD oil is expensive. And if you're trying to get better, and all of a sudden you find out that that product isn't 250 milligrams, it's really only 5 milligrams, but it's been labeled incorrectly, you may stop buying that product completely. The entire industry could go away, and that ability for that retailer to sell could go away. So I can tell you that those companies, The whether it's a retailer, manufacturer, wholesaler, distributor, they're very aware of that impact and they're very concerned. So what they've done is to go to the other end of that to say that they need to look at their supply chains, and they need to figure out where that product really does come from and that they meet their overall standards. So what companies will do is they'll set a standard. So they'll say, here's what we expect from our suppliers. And then they'll start to test against it. They'll look for documentation. They'll, you know, such as a food fraud vulnerability assessment. And then also go visit people. And they'll look and really see if they have enough production to make this product, where product came from. And they'll try to look all the way up the supply chain. Because, again, the impact can be absolutely immense on their bottom line.
I wonder how much this comes down to relationship building, knowing your farmer, knowing your grower, and having those solid business relationships across the board.
Well, we constantly get the question of, well, you know, who can we trust? And the key is always, every situation, we have to remove morals and ethics and personal feelings from the equation. We need to look at every situation and look at if there's a fraud opportunity or not. Doesn't matter if you're buying from your brother or someone from halfway around the world. And so the relationships are important, but trust but verify. Because also one of the ways that there's the most vulnerability is in that trusted relationship. Look at, like, you know, different type of family abuse or embezzlement within families, physical abuse within families, that even that closest relationship can have opportunity. So again, to step back, is that we just need to look, again, without emotion, at every situation and look at if there's a fraud opportunity and then see what we can do to reduce it. If your supplier has a real problem with you looking very closely, that's not your problem, that's their problem. Because if they are high quality vendor trying to sell a higher quality product, then they want to have more oversight. Because if you're more knowledgeable about the way that you buy your product. Say that retailer that does audits and inspections for organic or fair trade. Then if you're making that product, then they're a better customer for you because you won't get undercut by other fraudulent suppliers.
Michigan State University has a food fraud initiative. We're talking with John Spink. He heads it up. We're looking at issues around food fraud as people question the integrity of organic products in particular. What factors do you take into account when buying food? Do you care if it's organic or local? Is cost above all else? Are you concerned about food fraud? Be part of the discussion at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about organic food fraud here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Despite strict regulations, contaminated supplies of fraudulent organic foods, they still make their way to the market, and there are serious crimes that undermine the legitimacy of farmers. So what does the USDA National Organic Program, what does it do to ensure trust in their products and retain people's confidence? It's a question we're asking along with your thoughts on the organic label, 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer with a mix of conventional and organic products? What do you want people to know about the work you do and about the certification process? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. John Spink is a food fraud expert at Michigan State University, and he stays with us. John, Rick from Seymour called and couldn't stay with us. He was walking into work, and Rick said he's been an organic farmer and has gone through a lot to get that certification and really wanted to reinforce just how difficult it is to get organic certification. What is that process like?
Well, yeah, it can be over years, depending on the current situation to buy new product, to just let the land convert over in a time period to organic. So it is a very costly process. And the key is looking at the other end of what the opportunity is to after that investment. And that's all of a sudden we're talking about investment. We're talking about the assurance that making that effort will pay off in the end. So what's happening starting at the USDA level, at the federal level, is to start to look at this, having a formal certification process and starting to evolve forward to see what we can do to make the system more secure and also have that investment be paid off. And the key here is really thinking about that economic growth because, you know, looking at higher value product, and U.S. has some of the highest valued production agricultural land in the world. So we have, as a country, we have a huge opportunity. And so as we start to put these systems in place for certifications, we start to look at more ways to secure that supply chain to make sure the product and market is what it says it is. Pardon me. So that's something we're getting in place, and it's evolving forward. The real key is here at the start is we're now starting to look at shifting from just kind of the testing or talking about the process to do it, the idea of think like a criminal, look for the fraud opportunities, and then really the big key, it sounds really simple, but to first conduct this assessment, the vulnerability assessment of why and how fraudulent acts could occur. And so what we're seeing is there at the federal level, starting to look at these assessments broadly, but then getting down to even regional. So say it's a specific type of cheese that's made specifically there, then that within the state is to first do an assessment of that to see what type of fraud has occurred, and then what's the role of the state inspector or investigators, what's the role of the food safety management system certifiers, and even then the players in the market, such as an association or the farmers themselves, to really look for that vulnerability, and then put plans in place that across the board, across the entire industry, that reduce that fraud opportunity. And the bad guys will move on to other products as a target. And basically, then you're going to be able to sell more of your high-value product.
You just dropped the word cheese. And, of course, that piques our interest here in Wisconsin. Is cheese fraud an issue that you see in the global food industry? What's going on in cheese?
Well, and one thing we look at the volume of certain types of volume, total volume of types of fraud that occur from kind of high to low. But you don't really care what the overall global estimate of the worst is. You care if your product is fraudulent. So it could be a very, very, very small market. But if there's 25 farmers in that market, then it's very personal to them. So that's what we want to look back at our own products and to see. Number one is look for incidents. Does this occur? Does cheese labeling occur? You know, could it be? Say it's Wisconsin cheese, but we're from Michigan, so we take Michigan cheese and label it and say it's Wisconsin cheese. So we need to look at those incidents. The key is when it's inside the packaging. Sometimes it's pretty hard to tell those minute differences without a little more inspection.
Let's bring in a call. Ryan is joining us from Woodstock, Illinois. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question surrounds milk. I wanted to know if there was any regulations for milk. I had a friend who was a milk truck driver. He'd go from farm to farm. Some farms claimed they were organic. Some farms claimed they weren't. And he said they all went into the same tank and went to an organic processor that they claimed was organic.
Ryan, thanks so much for the call. John, what about the milk industry?
Well, so whenever we hear a suspicious activity, then we have a process to look at that. So a key is we first look at, you know, well, the nature of what happened. But we're looking at, you know, is there a known incident? And so yes, we now have a known incident of the suspicious activity is that organic and non-organic milk goes into a truck that's organic product, and then it's distributed as organic. And then we'd look at other test samples. At this point, we don't have test samples, but we'd go out and try to find that specifically, you know, what route was it on, what were the tests. And then we go through another process to look at, you know, in the marketplace, have we seen this as an incident other places in the market? How would we test for it? You know, are there different ways to look for some type of marker that's in the organic or non-organic milk, and then really start to gather the information? So a key is this is exactly the type of situation where there needs to be a system that we find the suspicious activity and we start to look at it. What that being said is that along the way is there's a lot more traceability and transparency in the supply chain. And milk is one in the U.S. that's very, very controlled for a number of reasons. But for one thing, it's a very short supply chain, both in time and distance. So that it's very quick for that product getting from the farm into a bottle and on your shelf. So with that shorter supply chain and faster supply chain with fewer players in it, then there's a lot more oversight.
We're looking at oversight, USDA standards around products and food fraud, instances of food fraud. John Spink is our guide. He's director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. Your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer who could qualify as organic, but you've chosen not to go through the USDA certification process? Is it not worth the money or the investment? Do you think USDA organic standards are too high? What about buying these products off the shelves? How do you feed yourself and your family? What choices do you make? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. John, the bar to become certified organic, it's quite high. Farmers who want to sell organic produce, they have to be fully organic for several years before they're eligible for the label. Is the bar too high? Should the USDA make this label more accessible for farmers?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that's key is we identify very detailed questions. And so that's one that should have some consideration, I'd say. But at the same time, you know, it's when we consider this, we look at why a lot of these certifications are there and what they're supposed to represent. So, you know, in that sense, it might be where the barrier to change from one operation to another is very costly, both in time and in economics, and it might just not be right for certain situations. One of my colleagues at Michigan State, David Ortega, he studies the willingness to change and ability to change. And that's a big difference for a manufacturer, because you may want to become organic, but it just there might not be an economic path for you to get there. And so it's really important to look at that of that balance. And at the other end is the consumer looking at, you know, the willingness to pay. And so when we say that a consumer prefers, say, organic product, then how much are they willing to pay for that? in some situations with some levels of trust, maybe it's in relation to the retailer or certain types of producers or industries where it comes from, consumers are willing to pay an awful lot more for some product. But it all builds on that consumer trust, and it gets back to, you know, the producer's ability to change.
There's one method of food fraud called salting, involving mixing in some organic product with a larger portion of something else. Can you explain that aspect of food fraud?
Yeah, so it's been fascinating to study this along the way. My work really started, it was more in packaging. And we were going to develop the next great anti-counterfeiting component to put on whatever product so you'd be sure it was a genuine product, whether it's sunglasses, consumer electronics, pharmaceuticals, or whatever. And along the way, we found that more industry people were asking more about their risk assessment, and they were asking about why they're vulnerable. And so we moved that direction away from the testing to looking at the overall strategy. So that's where this has shifted to look at you know, things like how we consider the market growth, and then if we can even protect the product if we move into that new market.
And so, in terms of salting, like there was this non-organic food cumin, batches of cumin were salted with peanut shells. What was happening there?
What we see along the way is that that there's kind of two things that go on. One is that say that you know that your supplier, say that you watch, you're delivering a bag of spices to a company, and you're watching how they look at it. Maybe they take a scoop right out of the top and test it of the bag, and then close the bag back up. So one thing there is that you're aware, as a fraudster, you're aware that they're not testing the whole bag. And so what you might do is you might think about salting your food. You put salt at the very end over the top. So in that case, you might put the genuine, 100% pure product along the top, because you know that's where they're going to take the sample from. So you'd salt the product to pass that test. Now, what happens a lot of times is that bad guys will really just dilute the product. So what happened with something like cumin is that it didn't change the color, but they put in a filler, which happened to be peanut shells. Now, if you put a filler in just some kind of rice or something like that, there's no allergic reaction, no allergen in there. But what happened with cumin is that the peanut shells had some of the residual peanut allergen in it, and so people got sick. And that's how really the incident was found, is because all of a sudden there was these reactions to it. So the combination of that, people want to dilute it, so that they can, you know, obviously the peanut shells are waste, but they get it for free. They may even have to pay for the peanut shells to be disposed of. And if they blend them in, then they can basically make that, you know, they can extend that batch twice as much. And then also then it's putting the pure product on top to pass the test.
Pausing right there with John Spink, who heads up the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State. We'll be back with this conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about food fraud, how it happens, and why. With the caveat here, the majority of organic farmers and food processors are driven by a true motivation to provide legitimate, high-quality products. But there are some bad apple situations. We're learning more about these situations as food fraud costs the global food industry upwards of $40 billion a year. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are you an organic farmer? How do you feel about organic food fraud? Does that negatively affect your business? Did you used to be a conventional farmer and then switch to organic practices? What differences do you notice? Join in 800-642-1234. Email us ideas@WPR.org. And Michigan State University's Food Fraud Initiative Director John Spink is our guide. John, let's look at inspectors themselves, because some organic farmers are able to hire their own inspectors to get through these steps. How can we rest assured the inspectors are doing their jobs?
Yeah, boy, you know, the thing is that we see is this is a food safety issue as well for food safety certification is who's monitoring. And you know, one thing we see is that there's a limited number of resources for the state food and agriculture department. And one thing then to get that certification is that people do use and people that they hire to come in and monitor their operations. And so there is a fraud opportunity there as well. But at the same time, there's a lot of oversight. And so we're trying to look at situations where that auditor will then be making a very clear statement of what they saw and making their claim. And that auditor then, if they're found to be fraudulent, then they can lose their job, and it could even possibly be criminal of the act that they're conducting.
Sounds like imported grains has been a big focus of the cases of food fraud. Are federal resources kind of strapped in order to catch all of these cases?
Well, one thing with crime is it's been around for a long time, believe it or not. But the thing is that we look at the fraudster and then we try to figure out how they were tempted to commit this act. So we'll never arrest our way to safety. Just like for food safety, we're never going to test our way to safety. We need to look at changing the overall systems themselves. And that's, again, going back to the vulnerabilities. And what we want to do is we want to put systems in place that the bad guys think there's a chance that they would get caught. These aren't like smash-and-grab criminals that's trying to get their drug fix for tonight, where they don't mind taking a chance of whether they're caught. These are usually very big operations. You know, even if it is a small company, it's still a company, and they probably still have, you know, most of their business is legitimate. They don't want to risk it. So we can spook these fraudsters quite a bit. You know, it's increasing the risk of getting caught or the cost of conducting the crime. So if we do have a more formal systems in place, then the bad guys know it. And I think this is a real key. So say it is a specialty cheese from a certain region of Wisconsin, that group can protect themselves and they can make themselves a hard target as a group. And the first step is, and this is the new training and programs that USDA, their organic program has, are to help people to understand the fraud opportunity, the review incidents, and implement a vulnerability assessment and strategy. That might sound like at PhD level university criminology work. It's not. And a real key is getting that down so that the people that are not experts in that field can start to look at their vulnerabilities as a group. And then if that group starts to implement the same kind of practices, the same type of documents, then it makes it harder and harder for bad guys to find a way to commit fraud. But a key is you don't have to be perfect. And your system doesn't actually have to be that robust. It has to just be better than the other industries and other opportunities. We just want the bad guy to think that they don't know what's going on, but they fear that they might get caught. And that's the key.
Do you see that we need more training in this area as the USDA looks to put more training out there? Is there a lack of it?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Is that I do a lot. I work a lot with the international, you know, Interpol. Police investigations around the world and Europol. I'm actually going to their next meeting in November and to talk about a country level. Vulnerability assessments and management strategy. So the same things we're talking about here that a group of 10 farmers could do together using that training from USDA is the same that's going on at the global level in huge police organizations. But what we've done is we've simplified the process and we've done the research to get down to the very basic steps just of how people can get started. It's like if you're going to run a marathon, the first thing you do is not go out and run 20 miles today. You get a plan over the course of this year. You're going to get off the couch. You're going to start walking. You're going to start to do these. You're going to do a 5K race first. And that's what we've got is we've broken down the process. So that first group that just says, hey, the 10 of us, we think we have a problem. Let's at least look at it. And then now we've got the key is we've got that research behind it. But we now have these simple, you know, 2-hour webinars that are recorded that people can start the process to understand it. And I think as they see it, they see they can do this. This is really not that hard to get started.
Talking with John Spink, he directs the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University. Still time for your questions about food fraud, 800-642-1234. John's sales of organic food in our country grew $3 billion from 2017 to 2018. As we see different pieces of the food industry seeing lots of growth, will we see food fraud continue to grow as a problem?
I think it's important to look at, you know, the crime review of all crime over time. And what we see is the bad guys constantly evolve. As soon as we do one thing, there's another thing. And as technology evolves, then the bad guy, it may stop the bad guy for now of one type of act, but then they continue to evolve. So that's another reason why we need to really focus on the fraud opportunity. So even say that those 10 farmers and some specialty type of cheese, if they study and respond to the current type of fraud in their industry, that's great for now, but the bad guys are going to evolve and change. So you really need to keep looking at it. Example in the past was obscene phone calls. And all of a sudden, when there was caller ID, obscene phone calls and phone stalking went away because we could call them back or see what the number was. But the bad guys didn't stop in that sense. They changed to more cybercrime for cyber stalking. So the bad guys continue to evolve. We just need to understand that is just the reality that we have. And if we look at it that way, and we think about we're taking one action, then we have to assume that it's a chess match. They're going to have a response. They're going to have two responses. We can think a couple steps down the road. So when we make our first action, we can consider how they might respond. So maybe it's even simpler what we do. Maybe we do two things right now or three things right now that are simple. But that may then lead that bad guy just to think that it's such a hard target, they're not even going to try to attack that group of 10 farmers.
John, as you work on the global level with Interpol here, what are the consequences here in the U.S. if you're caught, having some type of food fraud? What are consequences? Jail time? Fines? What does it look like?
A big challenge for all of criminal justice, crimes theory, criminology is how do you prevent and what are really deterrent actions or what is the level of penalty that will lead people not to act. Now, if you've never been convicted of a crime, I mean, I'd rather not be a convicted felon. So there's a lot of activities that I would not even tempt me at all because I would work even the remote chance that I would get caught. I wouldn't do that. But there's some people, if they already are a felon or they have other problems, they're not worried about breaking the law. We want to shift all the way back to looking at the goal is to not catch bad guys, is stop this from occurring in the first place. So we're really shifting from the more straightforward type of penalties to consider them like jail time. For us, we focus on them as a business. And the biggest hit on a business is the risk to their business or the actual losses. So if all we do is sit at the border and find product and seize it and destroy it, then we're making a major impact on bad guys' business because we're taking the whole shipping container. Say that was that cumin and they put 10% filler in it and we seize it. We find it and seize it. They lost the whole shipping container. They lost that 80% that was genuine product, and that really hits them as a business, and that's something we can really do, and that's immediate right now. At the border, if you said that there was a shipping container and it said it was T-shirts and it was actually hammers, now they could be. You could own both products. They could be genuine product, but if you have the wrong type of product on the label, that's technically smuggling. That doesn't need to go to a judge or a court or anything. The customs agents right there can seize that shipment and destroy it because that's smuggling. And so we now are starting to look at what do we have under our control? And one is that those kind of intense customs activities and then that ability to test whether it's a T-shirt or a hammer.
John, thanks for joining us. John Spink is director of the Food Fraud Initiative at Michigan State University and assistant professor in the Department of Supply Chain Management. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
WPR has been on the air since 1917, a pioneer in the development of radio. A lot has happened since then, and listener support is the foundation. You've helped us expand access with stations all over the state and the WPR app, and you've helped provide informative and enjoyable content on 3 networks and the web. You've made our remarkable history possible, and you carry us into the future. Thank you.
Shortly after taking office, Governor Evers appointed